I'm Nadja Swart for business.com, and joining me today is Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. Also the global leading voice on abrupt climate change, which is leading to near-term human extinction. Professor McPherson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
You believe that we are already in the midst of abrupt climate change. So can you first clarify what are the fundamental differences between abrupt climate change and climate change? And what is the basis of your claim that abrupt climate change has engaged?
Right. So most people refer to anthropogenic climate change, climate change caused by humans, as opposed to the, quote, natural climate change, which has occurred in the past many times, primarily as a result of the Milankovitch cycle. And people can look that up. It's easy enough. It's simple to understand. It has to do with a slight wobble of the Earth's rotation. In any event, we have, through human activity, we have far exceeded what goes on with the Milankovitch cycle. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concluded that climate change is abrupt in its October 8, 2018 report, Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees. And I'm going to quote here from that report, quote, "These global level rates of human-driven change far exceed the rates of change driven by geophysical or biosphere forces that have altered the Earth system trajectory in the past. Even abrupt geophysical events do not approach current rates of human-driven change," end quote. So in other words, as a result of human activity, industrialization, putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we have far exceeded what has ever happened in Earth's past. And we go back 2 billion years with this information. So in the last 2 billion years, there has not been anything that even closely parallels what human activity is producing in terms of the rapidity of climate change. So that's a big deal, because every organism on the planet is able to adapt or not to changes in the environment based on the speed of those changes. So the rapidity of the change in environment that's going on right now exceeds the ability of vertebrates to keep up. This, according to a peer-reviewed paper, it exceeds the ability of mammals to keep up. This, according to peer-reviewed evidence. As vertebrate mammals, we fall into that category, both categories of species that are being outstripped. The reference to vertebrates refers to a paper that indicates we are lagging behind the ability to keep up, vertebrates are, by a factor of 10,000 times. So that's a big deal. You know, so as the environment changes, if any organism can't adapt to those changes in environment, then that organism goes extinct. That is what has happened over the course of the last 2 billion years on this planet. It's happened with several species in the genus Homo already. And to think that it couldn't happen to our species, which I sometimes call our favorite species, requires a lot of hubris.
You've criticized the IPCC as being too conservative a scientific body, though, and that they dilute their records. So is it safe to say that, you know, the data you just referred to is actually quite vanilla compared to your understanding?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even the very conservative peer-reviewed journal Bioscience in its March 2019 issue referred to the IPCC. The title of that paper is called "Statistical Language Backs Conservatism in Climate Change Assessments," and they were referring specifically to the climate change assessments put out every few years by the IPCC. Statistical language backs conservatism. So in other words, the IPCC remains conservative in its approach. So I think it's safe to say that when the IPCC itself concluded that we were in the midst of abrupt climate change, more abrupt than anything in planetary history so far, I suspect it's worse than they're letting on. Of course it is, because that's been the case with almost everything they've released. Bear in mind that the way the IPCC works, these working groups have to reach consensus. Everybody in the group has to agree on every single finding. What that means is if one person disagrees, it doesn't go forward. So that tends to water down the findings. And then it has to go through a political process. Government entities have to approve the assessments before they're released. So all of that tells me that conservatism is bound to result. And in fact, it has.
Could it not be argued, though, that those scientists that have a vote and an opinion when it comes to consensus that believe that it's less dire than was projected, it also means that perhaps it's skewed in that way?
Well, it could be. Yes. I mean, in general, paid climate scientists, and I'm not a climate scientist. I've never claimed to be a climate scientist. I'm a biologist. I'm familiar with conservation biology primarily, and also with the importance of the rate of change with respect to evolution by natural selection. So it could be that paid climate scientists have incentives to report that the situation is not as bad as it actually is. And I see this very frequently when people accuse me of being insane, for example, or that my ideas are crazy. There's a lot of privilege associated with being a paid climate scientist. Most of these people are on university campuses. I spent more than 20 years as a professor on university campuses. There's an enormous amount of privilege that goes along with that situation. So I realized that it was the way we were living that was driving us to extinction. And so I changed the way I was living. I started living off grid and opted out of the monetary system, stopped taking paychecks in May 1st, 2009, because I realized it was the monetary system that was driving us to extinction. So I just walked away from that. And man, was that ever a mistake, because it's hard to get along in this world without money.
100%, especially like at the rate which is accelerating. But you've argued that climate engineering is not an option. It's not going to help us. Trying to like cut our carbon emissions, it's too late. Essentially, anything that anyone suggests, it's too late, it's not going to help us, we're doomed. So in that vein, why did you go off the grid if you don't believe that it's actually going to make a difference?
I didn't discover the idea of abrupt, irreversible climate change until I started living off grid. I also didn't discover the aerosol masking effect until I started living off grid. Had I known about either one of those, I would still be on a university campus making six figures, enjoying an enormous amount of privilege, and able to defend myself against a coordinated defamation campaign using the attorneys on campus. As it is now, I'm on my own. People can say whatever they want about me, and apparently it's all good. So had I known 15 years ago what I know now, I would still be working on campus. I would still be considered part of the family that my mother and siblings belong to. I would still have all kinds of personal relationships that have simply faded away because I'm the crazy one. That's the conclusion of almost everybody who used to interact with me.
Well, that's a very, very similar experience to the experience that, I don't like using this term, but climate deniers, you know, have to go through. They're also shunned from communities. They're fired from universities because they don't agree with the consensus. So does this not cause you to pause and think,
maybe I'm crazy after all?
No, not that. But that the science of climate and attempting to understand something as complex as climate science when it comes to planet Earth is so almost, for lack of a better word, you know, arrogant in the sense that how could we possibly, that whether it's climate heretics or dissidents or you, that the message to be taken from it is that we cannot be sure, that no data is actually reliable or definitive, at least.
Right. Right. We've come a long way in the last 50 years with respect to climate change. And we know with great certainty how to determine the planetary temperature. You know, that process used to be greatly hampered by our lack of understanding about the urban heat island effect. So almost all the temperatures, almost all the thermometers in the world are in cities. Of course they are. And cities don't cool down at night nearly as well as rural areas do. But there have been tremendous changes and advancements in the science that allow us now to compensate for those errors we were making before. So I would argue that we continue to be very conservative in our approach. And the IPCC is a classic example of that conservatism. The peer-reviewed evidence is conservative as well. Could it all be wrong? I don't much buy into the idea of hope, but I sure as hell hope so. I hope that it's all wrong. I do not want to be in the midst of a mass extinction event, at least the ninth. I do not want to be in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. There's almost everything that I report about, I wish were not true.
That is what you believe, though. Apart from the fact that you wish it wasn't the case, you do believe, and you have made damning projections regarding, you know, the future of humanity. And I'm going to go back to the first one. In 2007, you predicted that by 2012, permanent blackouts would start happening in cities due to peak oil, which is going to sound funny coming from me sitting in South Africa and in the midst of a power crisis. But as we discussed before the interview, it's for a different reason. But that prediction did not materialize.
There's power outages all over the world right now.
They are, but they're not permanent, and they're not completely damaging in a sort of irreparable kind of way.
Yes, that's true.
How do you explain that prediction not having materialized?
Well, two things. One, I was not relying to nearly as great an extent on the peer-reviewed literature then as I am now. Mm-hmm. And second, because I didn't know about the aerosol masking effect and because I forgot about the implications of nuclear power plants melting down, I was biased toward a different set of living arrangements than the one that almost everybody occupies now.
What were you biased towards?
I was biased towards anything different from the standard approach. The standard approach is everybody lives the same way. Everybody has 2.5 children. The children grow up, they go to school, some more, they fall in love, they get married, they have 2.5 children, they work until they can't work anymore, they work until they're exhausted, they retire, they draw a paycheck. It's all the same. Everybody cheers on the same thing for everybody all the time. And anybody who acts differently, anybody who deviates from that standard path is weird, is viewed as a little bit odd, a little bit weird, a little bit not fitting in. And maybe because I have a lifetime of not quite fitting in, I'm inclined to think that just fitting in, just following the normal path, is not something everybody should do.
But has this personal experience of going against the grain, not just for the sake of doing so, but because of what you really believe, not given you some sort of feeling of resonating with the climate scientists that have been shunned as heretics on the other spectrum? Yes, but have you connected with scientists like Judith Curry, Dr. John Christie, to bounce around ideas and perhaps just, you know, try and understand the situation better, considering that it is probably one of the hardest things that we can ever be sure about?
Right. I just don't see any significant evidence to support their ideas. There is no peer-reviewed evidence, and that's the gold standard for scientific knowledge. There is no peer-reviewed evidence to support the statements that they are making. And in terms of contacting people, I had a radio show on the Progressive Radio Network for 7 years. And we talked with a few climate scientists, but most climate scientists, most paid climate scientists, won't talk with me in public.
You're that crazy dude.
Exactly.
Doom and gloom prophet. But
yes,
going back to your perspective on the IPCC being, you know, diluting their records, that's probably the institution in the world that is relying on the most peer-reviewed research papers.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons that leads to the dilution. The peer-reviewed process tends to produce very conservative results. And then you try to get 15 or 25 people together in a room and evaluate those results. Of course, the standard is going to come down all the time, because scientists tend to not agree with other scientists. And when they do, it has to be based on a very conservative approach.
But doesn't that reality sort of dilute the credibility of relying on peer-reviewed science?
It actually ensures that the science is conservative. Remember that by the time the IPCC general assessment comes out, the information in there is 5 to 10 years old, because it takes that long to go through the review process, get it through the government process, the scientific and the political review processes. So one of the consequences is that the IPCC's general assessments tend to be stunningly conservative, even more conservative than the peer-reviewed literature they rely upon. So I think that goes in the direction of supporting the findings of the IPCC while recognizing that they are watered down, while recognizing that even when they say things like even abrupt geophysical events do not approach current rates of human-driven change, that's the trimmed down version. It's way worse than that. And that was from 2018.
What do you think motivates them to be diluting the results and misleading the public if they are doing so?
Two things. The peer-reviewed process tends to produce very conservative results. So it has to get by an editor or editors. It then has to go out for peer review. Those peer reviews are anonymous. So as somebody submitting the paper, I don't know who's reviewing it. They might disagree with everything I say. They might disagree with my public image. They might disagree with a lot of things that cause them to focus not solely on the science.
Mm-hmm. So the whole peer review process is actually sort of systemically flawed.
No, it's systemically conservative. It produces conservative results and therefore what we call reliable knowledge. It doesn't get through peer review in general unless it's really, really good and really, really conservative.
Going back to your reference that consensus is required for an IPCC report to go out.
Right.
You, on your website, argue that a scientist admitting that we don't need more study of an issue is stunning. So this is hard for me to digest, because this implies that, you know, science is settled, which by definition contradicts the essence of what science is, as the, you know, axiomatic nature of science is further exploration, because there are always more accurate explanations.
But some science is settled.
When there are so many scientists that disagree with the consensus, how is it settled?
We know what the rate of acceleration of a falling object is. We know what the global average temperature of the planet is. We know what the temperature of the oceans are, different places around the globe. We know what the salinity of the oceans are around the world. There are a lot of things that we actually know with great certainty, and science as a process contributes to that great certainty. through the peer-reviewed process by being conservative and leading, therefore, to reliable knowledge, knowledge that anybody will agree with. Is the world a complex place? Is climate change complex? Yes, absolutely. There's no question about that. But there are some things that we know with great certainty that would take a stunning change in information to disprove. And that's the case with many of the elements, not just of climate change, but various other aspects of the world.
Well, two of the fundamental premises upon which you base your argument that we are in the midst of abrupt climate change is that the evidence of extreme weather events that are unprecedented in nature and severity are clear evidence of that, and also the highest recorded temperatures have occurred recently. However, other scientists, climate scientists, have argued that the paleoclimate records indicate very extreme weather events that are in no way less significant than what we're experiencing now. And also, just as a direct example, in an interview with Dr. John Christie, who pioneered the satellite data temperature recordings, he said that over the last 43 years, there has been a 0.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. And also claim that extreme weather events are unprecedented because the data being looked at spans about, 40 years. So it's a very, very small sample and it skews any kind of conclusion that can be drawn from it. So what do you say to that?
I'm confused because, yes, there have been extreme weather events and, yes, the temperature of the planet has increased greatly in the past 43 years, in the last 50 years, in the last 100 years.
Would you say that a 0.5 degree Celsius increase is a great increase?
Yes, absolutely.
So you concur that that is a reliable conclusion in terms of temperature increase?
Yes, we're in the midst of the great, most rapid temperature increase, as even the IPCC admits, in as I indicated in their October 8th, 2018 report, global warming of 1.5 degrees. Yes, the temperature is rising very rapidly, and that's what's driving the mass extinction event. So on some of these issues, there is no disagreement between the consensus of paid climate scientists and the people who find themselves out of favor with that group. But that doesn't mean we're in the midst of a cooling event, as some people say. We're not going into an ice age. You know, people point very frequently to the 1970s when they said, but scientists said in the 1970s we were entering an ice age, therefore they can't be believed. Well, a few scientists in the 1970s thought we were headed into an ice age, but it was a very small minority of the consensus finding at that time was that we are headed into, and in fact, we're currently already in the midst of a global heating event. And we still are.
If, as you say, it is a global heating event, though, does that not in itself imply that it is a natural cycle of, the planet's cooling and heating?
No, it's not natural at all. It's not all cycles. Yes, there were warming events in the past. Yes, there were cooling events in the past. And as I indicated, the warming that naturally occurred was due to a slight wobble in the Earth, referred to as the Milankovitch cycle. What's going on right now is far in excess of those temperature changes that were recorded in the past based on proxy records. Mm-hmm. So we're beyond the notion of relatively gradual climate change. The kind of thing I was studying in the early 1980s when I was in graduate school was gradual changes in global average temperature. What we're in now, what we're in the midst of now, is a much more rapid rate of change than we've ever observed, even using proxy records like tree rings and so on.
And it's this rapid warming that you believe is going to engage the release of methane gas from the Arctic. You mentioned that there were three primary sources of methane release and that this will be the end of humanity on Earth.
Again, this is according to Natalia Shikova and her research team, based on their findings. And they have predicted, even in the absence of an ice-free Arctic, even if we maintain ice in the Arctic Ocean, which seems unlikely to persist very much longer, but even if it does, they predicted a 50 gigaton burst of methane, which would profoundly and much more rapidly than is currently going on warm the planet. And we can't take any more warming because the environment is changing so quickly already that vertebrates and mammals can't keep up. We're vertebrate mammals. We should be concerned.
Other climate scientists have argued that the amount of methane released will not do the damage perceived by some scientists because it'll be either oxidized or rest in seabeds, I think it is.
Right. So it's being released from seabeds, most notably the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And so I don't think that's a go-to solution.
But is it a possibility?
I don't think so.
And the fact that it has a very short life?
It has a relatively short life if we turn off the source. But we're not turning off the source. The source, it's a self-reinforcing feedback loop, so it keeps accelerating, more and more is released. And the oxidation, when it oxidizes, it turns into, you guessed it, water vapor and carbon dioxide, two powerful greenhouse gases. So, you know, we can hope that it oxidizes very quickly and therefore turns into only carbon dioxide and water vapor, which are both strong greenhouse gases. Or we can hope, again, that it is captured into the place that it's being emitted from, the continental shelves. But I don't think either of those is a reliable option. Shikova and her research team continue to publish peer-reviewed papers on the topic and continue to be made fun of by other paid climate scientists. But nobody is arguing with the data. Nobody is arguing with their with the data that they are presenting. They're only arguing with them, like me, as being extremists in their findings. I only rely upon peer-reviewed evidence and the people who produce those papers. So I'm not making this stuff up.
But we have established that the peer-reviewed data and the credibility thereof has become unreliable.
No, we have not.
The IPCC is all based on peer review data, and you say they're too conservative of a scientific body and that they're diluting the results. I mean, that's based on peer-reviewed research.
Yes. So what I'm saying is they're too conservative. The peer-reviewed evidence is very conservative. I'm not saying what you're saying is that it goes the other direction. It's not anti-conservative. It's very conservative. The findings are very reliable, and they don't go far enough. Each new assessment, you know, the assessments come out every few years, and each new assessment looks back at the previous assessment and concludes, oh my, it's worse than that. Every single one of them so far, each of the six, has concluded that the previous assessment was too conservative. And so now, even the IPCC admits that we're in the midst of abrupt and irreversible climate change. Mm-hmm. Irreversible. Mm-hmm. Specifically, and I'm going to quote from the IPCC Special Report on the Ocean and Cryosphere in a Changing Climate, which came out September 24th, 2019. Quote, ocean acidification and deoxygenation, ice sheet and glacier mass loss, and permafrost degradation are expected to be irreversible on timescales relevant to human societies and ecosystems. End quote. So, and they're quoting peer-reviewed papers, five peer-reviewed papers to reach that conclusion. So the IPCC concludes that we're in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. They did that 10 years after I reached the same conclusion. That's why I am indicating that the IPCC is too conservative. If I could reach that conclusion 10 years before they did, then maybe they're not quite keeping up with the peer-reviewed evidence.
Your conclusion also goes a very damning step further. In 2012, you predicted the likely extinction of humanity by 2030. 2018, you adjusted it, and you said that by 2026, it is highly unlikely, and you will be severely shocked if you're alive, if humans are still on planet Earth.
So I've had peer-reviewed papers published in each of the last 2 years, 2021 and 2022, pointing to causes of rapid rise in planetary temperature. So, and you know, those went through the peer-reviewed process, so they're conservative in their findings, but they have, my research has been supported by the peer review process, not to mention the co-authors with whom I wrote those papers. So I want to point to an example of a species that went extinct very quickly and that actually had some advantages over humans. So the species is a San Benedicto rock wren, which was living on the San Benedicto Island off the Pacific coast of Mexico. And on August 1st, 1952, the San Benedicto Island became volcanic. It blew up. The San Benedicto rock wren was never seen again. It was extinct within a week, maybe two. It could fly. We cannot fly. Individuals undoubtedly flew to the nearby islands and even to mainland Mexico. But a San Benedicto rock wren was never seen again. That happened very quickly. It happened in a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. To think that as a result of loss of habitat, we would not go extinct as well is pure hubris, the likes of which is only displayed by humans.
Are we not completely disregarding the very clear capability of human beings to adapt to changing climate, environment, all of those things? And I have to bring in here that credit must be given to the fossil fuel industry, because if it were not for that, then these climate change related deaths that we're being told all about today would be way worse. How are we protecting ourselves from earthquakes, from floods, from rising sea levels, droughts, all of those things? It's by virtue of the fact that we have power, fuel, and human ingenuity to allow ourselves to adapt, and as we have done for very long. So yes. Is the sweeping, there's no hope, nothing will save us prediction, whether or not it may be true is irrelevant, but is it not possibly harmful to the potential chance that by virtue of human ingenuity that we've been forced to technologically advance ourselves and have managed to do so in the past, that we may just adapt once again?
You know, I'm frequently accused of giving up. I don't even know what that means. I'm the person who supported the mirror reflection framework, which I thought was our last chance. You can find it at mirror.org, and mirror is spelled M-E-E-R, mirror.org. And I thought it was a great idea. The idea was released after the founder of the idea, Dr. Ye Tao at the Harvard Rowland Institute, visited with me, and I thought it was a great idea, but that was more than 5 years ago. I thought it was a great idea. And governments of the world and wealthy people of the world have known about it now for more than 5 years. Nobody's doing anything.
Why didn't we?
John Kenneth Galbraith wrote on page 22 of his 1977 book, The Age of Uncertainty, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote, quote, "People of privilege will always risk their complete destruction rather than surrender any material part of their advantage," end quote. The people of privilege who could pay our way out of this or could at least make an effort are not doing so. Other people like you and me, have been asked to make sacrifices, and we have. We're asked every day to stop driving so much, to insulate our homes, to do all these other good things that millions of people have done. But the few hundred people who could actually fix this have not put in a dime, have not supported the mirror reflection framework.
Why would they not do so unless they do not believe that without that, they will die?
I suspect that there are two reasons. One, I already mentioned, people of privilege will always risk their complete destruction rather than surrender any material part of their advantage.
They'd rather die.
Perhaps rather than give up privilege, they would die. Mm. Perhaps rather than pay billions of dollars for a project that might or might not work, perhaps they would rather die and have their entire family die with them. I don't know. I can't speak for billionaires. I've never been one. I've never even met one.
To close off with, and I really do wish that we had more time, but you are of the view that we have 3 years left.
I suspect most of us don't have that long, but yes.
Even worse. What is it that encourages you to then get up in the morning or even do interviews like this, considering that it's, you know, becoming a bigger and bigger fraction of your remaining time?
Gabor Mate said, in response to palliative care, to hospice care, he said, quote, accepting inevitability, end quote. That's what we must do. I'm trying to inform people of the evidence I have uncovered, all of which has been discovered by other people, and I've simply come across it and put it together into a cohesive package. Mm-hmm. I would encourage everybody who's watching or listening to this to track down Ray Bradbury's short story. You can find it online for free, The Last Night of the World. In The Last Night of the World, everybody knew they were going to die in their sleep tonight. Nobody went crazy. Nobody tried to steal money from anybody else. Nobody on the East Coast flew to the West Coast so they could get three more hours. Nobody flew from here to New Zealand so they could get an extra day or two. If people have 3 years, that will give them time to come to grips with the idea. If they have one night, then people are going to go nuts. Then people are going to go crazy. Then there will be chaos. I'm trying to prevent chaos. I'm trying to prevent chaos, not contribute to it. The people who are lying to us about abrupt, irreversible climate change are the ones who are going to trigger chaos in the future because nobody's been informed. If nobody knows what's coming, do you think they're going to be happy when it actually hits them?
Why would these people want to keep it from them? Like, what do they have to gain?
They don't want to give up their privilege today so that other people can survive tomorrow. People ask me all the time, how much time do I have? And from an individual perspective, people say, how much time do I have? Professor McPherson, how much time do I have? And I tell them, you have 3 minutes. You have 3 minutes, and with every breath, you get a reset. Live like it. Live like every breath matters, because it does. Live like every moment matters, because it does. That's all I'm trying to say.
And I mean, apart from the fact that we are talking about the potential end of the world in 3 years, that is a really beautiful message to end this conversation off with.